Today, provide you with in-depth news and expert analysis, tell you the whole story and the bigger picture. Bring you the news you want to know only on Today.
You're listening to Today, I'm Sui. Since embarking on the journey of reform and opening up 40 years ago, China has transformed itself into the world's second largest economy, bringing tremendous changes to its people's lives and the global economy. Over the past four decades, China's import and export of goods have increased by almost 200 times, and those of services by nearly 150 times. The emerging economy has seen over $2 trillion of foreign investment during that period. China has also become the world's largest trader of goods, the biggest tourism market, and a major trading partner with over 130 countries. From 1978 to 2017, China's per capita disposable income grew by over 22 times. About 740 million people were lifted out of poverty, and the number of jobs created was doubled. Meantime, since the reform and opening up, China has played an increasingly active and responsible role in such global issues as improving economic governance, supporting other developing countries, and tackling the financial crisis. The Belt and Road Initiative proposed by China 5 years ago has grown into a platform for all parties to share opportunities and pursue common development. Over 140 countries and international organizations have signed BRI cooperation documents with China. So in this episode, we will discuss China's reform and opening up 40 years on, what's been achieved, how it's been done, and also their implications to China and the world. The panel is Michael Powers, Zurich Insurance Group Professor of Risk and Finance at Tsinghua University, Victor Gao, Vice President of the Center for China and Globalization, Giles Chen, Visiting Professor of the Guanghua School of Management of Peking University, Adjunct Professor of Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. If you want to listen to this episode again or catch up on other topics, download our podcast, World News Analysis. So let's begin with a general question. What is China's reform and opening up all about? We know Chinese people and China watchers around the world must be familiar with those terms like seeking the truth from facts, crossing the river by feeling the stones, or the white cat, black cat metaphor by Deng Xiaoping. But I guess some of our young listeners want to know more details about what really happened back then. So their life today is very much different from the life of their father generation when they were young. So Victor, let's begin with you. From your own experience in everyday life and also career life, what's China's reform and opening up all about? What's changed since the reform and opening up 40 years ago?
Well, thank you very much. 40 years ago, China was locked up in a huge ideological box, and productivity was stalling, and the living standards of the people were really suffering. And part of the reason was because of this political splitting of the hair of everything into capitalism versus socialism. At that time, China believed whatever that is capitalism is bad, is doomed to failure. Whatever that is socialist is doomed to be great success. But the reality is actually just the opposite. And when Deng Xiaoping came out, he urged a reform. That is, to completely revamp your thinking and to give up the old, outdated, ossified ideology. And he emphasized that to seek the truth from the facts. And I think these reforms, both political as well as economic, were the beginning and the foundation of everything that China has done over the past 40 years. And opening to the outside world was also something very natural, mainly because whatever that was in China was locked up in an ossified situation. And we need to introduce capital, advance the ideas and technologies, the advanced way of manufacturing things from abroad. And opening of China to the outside world would expose China to whatever that will work in the foreign countries, mostly in the capitalist countries. And this is what Deng Xiaoping called socialism with Chinese characteristics.
So, by the way, Victor, 40 years is a long time. How would you divide the past 40 years into different phases? For example, what I can think of is the year of 1992, when Deng Xiaoping made his southern tour, and also 2001, when China joined the WTO.
Oh, definitely. 40 years should be a long time. However, in my own personal experience, 40 years just came and went like a split of a second. And lo and behold, China is completely transformed. I would say, yes, from 1978 to 1972, let's say, when Deng Xiaoping did the southern tour, this probably could be one period. And then from 1972 all the way till around the century, around the time of China joining WTO, that's another period. And then ever since the time of China's joining the WTO all the way till now, that could be classified as the third period. However, I would say the 40 years, and however you divide them into, are all part and parcel of the same event. That is, China never wanted to look back. China wanted to focus on the future. China wanted to do all the experiments and trials and errors in the right way. And China wanted to devote all the resources on the economic development. And I think maintaining stability at home and keeping peace abroad became the two important pillars upon which all the economic and political transformation in China have taken place.
So, Michael, why is reform and opening up so important for China?
I think that for all the reasons that Victor mentioned, it has been this 40-year period has been, in some sense, in a historical sense, a blink of an eye. And that's why some people would refer to what has occurred with China's economy as the China economic miracle. I think that if one goes back to the ideas of Deng Xiaoping, Victor was getting at, and what I would emphasize is that Deng Xiaoping pointed out that the Western economies, the so-called capitalist economies, did not operate completely free of government involvement. And so the socialist economies, there's no reason why they should be operating completely independently of market forces. And I really think that market forces are part of one of the very, you know, very important ingredients in moving this forward. That and also the opening, as Victor suggested, to international ideas and in particular international capital. So these were some of the very first things that were attempted as early as 1978 in the agricultural sector, the de-collectivization, which didn't occur overnight, but occurred slowly and permitted farmers to take responsibility for their individual plots of land and to receive and keep the profits that they gained through their work, and at the same time opening the country to foreign investment. And with that foreign investment, of course, came the opportunity to build all the various sectors, and especially manufacturing in China, but also introduce new ideas and an exchange of ideas between China and the rest of the world.
So Giles, we know reform and opening up is not just something for China. So what does reform and opening up in China mean for the rest of the world?
I think it's had a huge impact on the rest of the world. And in fact, I think the rest of the world overlooked what was going on in China for a long time. And in some cases, only in the last couple of years, that people in Europe and America have started to really take notice of China and how big it is and how it's grown, and in particular in America, how it challenges the American status quo. So I remember going on a radio show in London, BBC, in November 1999, when it was announced that China had decided to join the World Trade Organization. And I was asked what the consequence of that was, and I said, well, this was in 1999, and I said, well, you're joining one-fifth of the world population to the rest of the world, and it's going to have an enormous impact on the price of products and on the availability of products and on everything else. And I remember the interviewer looking at me rather bemused way, because I don't think that people really understood what the consequences would be. But the consequences have been enormous. Globalization has had a huge impact on the rest of the world. We've seen it with Brexit. We're seeing it now with populism in the rest of Europe. We're seeing it also in America with the election of Trump. And China has a lot to do with that. I just want to make a couple of other comments, if I may. I think that Deng Xiaoping's role is absolutely fundamental in this. And I think that the person he was and the strength and understanding of China and also the understanding of the political process within China that made this all possible. And I don't think anybody else or very few other people could have done it the way he did it. And I think Victor's analysis is good, but I would just say that I think in the late 1980s, after Tiananmen, there was a period when Li Peng was the prime minister and Jiang Zemin became the president, when things really closed down. And there was really, for a couple of years, considerable doubt about, you know, whether the reform process would continue as it had been. And that's why I think Deng actually went on his so-called holiday to Wuhan and Shenzhen and other places and started making comments from the south of China about how useless the government was in Beijing and how he was going to get rid of them and replace them all. And I think that really put a bomb under the government, and it put the reform process back on course. And so that was just another contribution from this extraordinary man who made the whole process possible.
Thanks. Now let's examine some of the key measures and achievements. Let's begin with the rural reform in the countryside of China. In the autumn 40 years ago, in 1978, 18 farmers in Xiaogang village in Anhui signed a secret agreement to divide communally owned farmland into individual pieces called household contracts. Michael also mentioned this. And the village became the birthplace of the reform in the countryside. We know rural reform is arguably one of the most important aspects of the entire reform and opening up. So, Victor, what's happened in rural China over the past 40 years? And also, what does this reform mean for the agricultural sector, the countryside, farmers, and also the urbanization process?
Well, 40 years ago, the Chinese countryside and the Chinese farmers or peasants, or whatever we call them, were locked up in this great experiment of people's communes. Basically, it's a highly collective farming participated by everyone in the same village, for example, on an equal work, equal pay basis. And the ideal, we don't need to argue about whether this ideal was a good one or a bad one, but this whole experiment eventually failed. Why? Mainly because while people enthusiastically participated in this people's commune experiment, productivity plummeted, and there was a great scarcity of agricultural produce, mainly because of the low level of productivity. And I think the Chinese communes were at a dead end. But what to do with this? That was the big issue. And I think the experiment in Anhui by a dozen or so Chinese farmers, at the risk to their own lives, for example, try to divide up the land and adopt a responsibility system based on their own personal or household production, really was designed to break away from the people's communal system. And when this experiment surfaced, the provincial leadership in Anhui and eventually the central government leadership in Beijing, headed by Deng Xiaoping, not only did not oppose them, but actually encouraged this experiment and waited to see how this experiment will result in result. And eventually, upon seeing the success of the experiment, decided to expand them on the national level. And allow me to mention one point. to conduct agricultural reform against the People's Commune's background was relatively easy compared with urban industrial reform, mainly because in the Chinese countryside at that time, the system was relatively primitive for the People's Commune. And you actually did not have large-scale industrialized production or scientific and research facilities or logistics, for example. And therefore, divide up the land and the means of production was relatively simple and straightforward. And also, the household basis was a very natural unit. You did not need to argue about it, and you did not need to cut corner. Basically, a family became a natural unit of production at that time. So when agricultural reform based on what we call household responsibility system started in the countryside, it really took off very quickly. It spread from one village in Anhui province to the four corners of the Chinese countryside within just a couple of years. And the People's Commune that were dominated in Chinese countryside for a decade or for more than one or two decades, for example, simply disintegrated, giving way to a new landscape of agricultural production based on household responsibility in China. And the Chinese economic reform not only started in the countryside, but really bore fruit in the countryside. And the Chinese farmers were the first generation of the Chinese people who really tasted the sweet fruits of the political and economic reform in China. And eventually, the great results started to spread to the urban industrial reform.
So another side of the rural reform is that millions of people from countryside moving to cities. So that's urbanization. Like Victor Gao mentioned, urbanization, urban development is much complicated compared with the rural reform. So about urbanization, Michael, how do you see the implications of rural reform to other parts of the Chinese economy? And also, what would you say are the major approach for Chinese policymakers to deal with this dramatic urbanization process?
I think, as Victor noted, it was easier there because of the setting, the agricultural setting, the small family units, and the ability to break the collective farms into smaller units made reform in the countryside easier. I think that that one had to go through, I mean, the government and the people of China had to go through a number of different trials in order to get to where we are today with the mixed economy of private companies, state-owned enterprises. There were, to begin with, basically, one thing I do think it's important that we note is that in this process of sort of feeling things from the bottom up and reforming from the bottom up, testing out what works, what doesn't work, and then going and encouraging government officials to support those methods that work, China took a very different path from the transitional economies of the former Soviet countries and the Eastern Bloc in Europe, in which many transitions occurred almost overnight. And there was chaos. There was great decline in economic growth, or actually decline in the economy as a whole. There was opportunity for tremendous corruption, cronyism, and so forth to creep in. China didn't have these problems because it took things gradually. And in the context of urbanization and the manufacturing sector, there were, as I said, there were experiments. There were special economic zones, especially in certain cities in the south. At one time, the People's Liberation Army was involved in businesses, but at a later date, that was prohibited. So it took many steps and many trials to get to the state where we are today. And I think that if one compares that to what happened in some of the other transitional economies, one really sees how the model that was put forward by Deng Xiaoping and carried out by the people in the government at the time was quite remarkable.
Hmm. So another major achievement when we talk about the changes taking place in the countryside is poverty alleviation, which is widely recognized as achievements of China in the past few decades. So Giles, how about this? I guess something particularly right must have been done beyond making people making the pie bigger for everyone, because I think we can argue a poverty alleviation is not just about economic growth, but also about distribution or social safety net, things like that.
Yes, I think a lot's been done by the government in the last few years, in particular to improve the situation in some of the far off places. But I think also the market has played a role, because I think that a big feature really of urbanization has been the migrant workers traveling from Western and Central China into, first of all, the new economic areas like Shenzhen and then Shanghai and later. And in fact, these migrant workers that have really built Shanghai, Beijing, all the buildings you see now, like Jinma and so forth, in Shanghai and in Beijing and Shenzhen and Guangzhou, are all made, constructed by these people who traveled thousands or hundreds of miles to work and then went back again. So I think that's and of course, taking back with them, the money which they've been paid for working on these construction sites, and also in the factories, the exporting factories which were developed in Shenzhen. So I think that's also played an important part in alleviating poverty in some of the poorer Western and Central areas of China. Mm. I actually, just coming on the show, looked at some very basic figures, and I think in the year 2000, in the rural areas, I think that no one had a car, and no families had a car, and I think only about 50 or 40% of families had a refrigerator. And if you look at the latest figures I could get hold of, which was 2016, every rural family now has a refrigerator, and about 40% have a car. So I think that tells you how significant the improvement has been in the lifestyle of the rural populations. I should just also mention the very successful development of town and village enterprises, which are really sort of joint ventures or collaborations between local governments and private entrepreneurs. In a unique Chinese way, people with ideas from local villages and towns, groups of people, got together with local government officials, and together they formed a very large number of enterprises to make all sorts of things. And TCL, for example, a very large television company, a Chinese company, is a result of a town and village enterprise. And there are many, many others. And I think this is another market-driven, an opportunity-driven success story behind alleviation of rural poverty.
So about poverty alleviation, Giles, what's still needed to finish this last mile? Because we heard the Chinese government promised to end extreme poverty by the year of 2020.
Well, I think they've done I think there are parts of China which you go to in Southwest, for example, where a lot of the minorities live, and parts of Sichuan province, Northeast and Northwest, where some of the fruits of the rural economic growth haven't extended as strongly as they have in other areas. And I think the government needs to do more. And I think they have to redistribute some of the profits and gains which have been made. Obviously, and you go to places like Shanghai and Shenzhen, you can just see. I've just come back from Guangzhou, and the money there, the wealth in Guangzhou is fantastic. Guangzhou is now richer per capita than many cities, towns in Britain, like Birmingham, for example. And so some of that money needs to be taken and invested, but put into the poorer areas. I think a lot's been done in infrastructure, but more could be done by the government on that.
Thanks. In this episode, we're discussing China's reform and opening up 40 years on, what's been achieved, how it's been done, and also their implications to China and the World. We are joined by Michael Powers, Zurich Insurance Group Professor of Risk and Finance at Tsinghua University, Victor Gao, Vice President of the Center for China and Globalization, Giles Chan, Visiting Professor of the Guanghua School of Management of Peking University, also Adjunct Professor of Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. This year marks the 40th anniversary of China's reform and opening up, which ushered in a new stage of development and brought about China's growth miracle. From rural areas to cities, from pilot programs to nationwide projects, from economic restructuring to the comprehensive deepening of reform, the past four decades have witnessed epic progress and historic leaps from an old country. China has grown into the world's second largest economy, the largest industrial producer, the largest trader of goods, and the holder of the largest foreign exchange reserves. We're going to take a short break here. In the next half, we'll continue our discussion about China's reform and opening up. We can talk about economic reform and also China's approach of opening itself to the rest of the world. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Today. We're discussing China's reform and opening up in this episode, what's been achieved, how it's been done, and also their implications to China and the whole world. The panel is Michael Powers, Zurich Insurance Group Professor of Risk and Finance at Tsinghua University, Victor Gao, Vice President of the Center for China and Globalization, Giles Chan, Visiting Professor of the Guanghua School of Management of Peking University, and Adjunct Professor of Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. If you want to listen to this episode again or catch up on other topics, download our podcast, World News Analysis. So in the next half, let's move on to economic reform, the general economic reform. In the beginning of the program, we mentioned several quite phenomenal numbers when it comes to the microeconomy of China, how it's been changed. And from the perspective of people's daily lives, we know back then, there were ration coupons issued to residents for the purchase of certain foodstuffs, including grain, flour, rice, oil, meat, as well as household items like clothing, television, bicycle. And also there were four essential household items that almost every Chinese household aspired to possess in the early 1980s. They were a wristwatch, a bicycle, sewing machine, and a radio set. So that sounds like ancient history, but apparently that's just one generation ago. So this country chose a unique path to develop its economy and making itself the second largest economy in the world. The path called socialist market economy with Chinese characteristics. So Victor, how would you define this socialist market economy with Chinese characteristic? Why is this definition important for the economic reform in China?
Well, as we mentioned, 40 years ago, China was locked up in this huge ideological box. People kept debating as to whether something was capitalist versus socialist. China tended to believe at that time that whatever that was capitalist was doomed to failure. Whatever that is socialist is a recipe for great success. The reality is just the opposite. China managed to achieve the highest level of egalitarianism in human history, possibly, but it was egalitarianism of poverty. Everyone was equally poor. Therefore, one major task for China is to decide which ideological outlook you need to adopt. And Deng Xiaoping basically said, socialism does not mean poverty. If socialism generates in poverty, something must be wrong. And he would say there must be a way that socialism will generate wealth rather than poverty. And therefore, he basically emphasized that China need to reform and China need to be flexible. And the system that China need to follow is what he called socialism with Chinese characteristics. And it's very important to focus on these Chinese characteristics, because I think these have been all enablers. Whatever that will work, whatever that can promote productivity and efficiency, could be adopted and added to the socialism that China was following. So socialism and socialist market economy with Chinese characteristics became an emancipating force, became a big enabler. and the Chinese people, the Chinese companies, the Chinese system were emancipated from the ideological burdens and liabilities and started to really do all kinds of experiments. And the real litmus test that they were interested in is always whether this is good for developing economy, whether this is good to improve living standards, whether this is good to bring better lives to the people, for example. And I think this is truly the basis of the liberating force in China over the past 40 years. And in this overall context, I think China was eager to learn from the rest of the world, and whatever practices or know-how or experiences that would do things better than what we here in China could do, could be accepted and could be taken over and could be introduced and absorbed in what we do in developing our economy. So the Chinese economy is not purely socialist, as most people would understand. It's not purely capitalist, as some other people would be afraid of, for example. But it's a socialism with all the flexibility and all the emancipating power that you can think of. And the real litmus test is seeking truth from facts. Whatever worked will be encouraged to work.
So we're talking about market economy, socialist market economy. Apparently, there is a relations between the role of the government and the role of the market. So Giles, how do you see Chinese policymakers have been dealing with this pair of relations?
I think that the Communist Party of China and the government have dealt very cleverly on the whole with the enormous challenge of bringing country like China into the modern age and supervising the reform and development. What China did, which Russia did not, was China changed the economy, but they did not change the government or the political situation. Whereas the Russians were persuaded by themselves and perhaps by the West also that it would be a good idea to become democratic at the same time as undertaking economic reform. And that didn't, as we all see, that hasn't worked out at all. Russia's hasn't really become a democratic country, and the economy has gone basically nowhere. I think what China did was to keep what it already had and to undertake incremental reform, which seemed to be sensible. And I think in that context, the government played a very important role by preserving a framework within which a reform could occur and by retaining control and retaining stability within the overall system, which they overall done extremely well. The other thing I would mention is that the policymakers at the top of the Chinese government are extremely well educated, extremely experienced. And if you look at countries like America and many other countries in Europe, like my own country, Britain, Chinese leaders compare very favorably because they've had many years of experience in all sorts of different jobs around the country and internationally before they become senior leaders in China. And they know a great deal, and they also often speak several different languages, and there are not many other, if any, countries which can produce the same caliber of leadership as the Chinese government does. Mm-hmm.
So, Michael, how did China manage to find this development path? Also, you told some story and made some comparison with other developing economies during this transition process. How unique is this path?
I think that there are some things that are very important to talk about with regard to the concept of socialism with Chinese characteristics. Victor had mentioned that the current economy, from his perspective, and I think it's a very reasonable way of looking at the economy, it's a mixture of some socialist components and some market or capitalist components, because certainly there's a large government presence in the market through the state-owned enterprises and government regulation, but there are also large private companies. However, I think that that it's also one of the things that that I find myself trying to explain when I talk to American friends who are not living in China, and they ask, "Well, how is it that China now has so many elements of capitalism, but it still calls itself socialist or communist. I think that what one thing that's important to keep in mind is that, yes, we could take a pragmatic view. We could say Deng Xiaoping was a pragmatist and learned the benefits or believed in the benefits and promoted them of market forces. But there's also another approach, which I think is a more theoretical Marxist approach. And I say this with some caution because I'm by no means a Marxist or an expert in that area. But if one were to look at, to go back to the collectivization of a farm, for example, what one has there is farmers working and all of the profits of their labor are distributed somewhat equally. So as Victor described, they're equally poor at that time. My understanding of Marxist theory is that that type of equality occurs at the very end, in the final stage of communism, when people are more enlightened and they've had an opportunity to go through different stages of economic development, including first the capitalist period and then the socialist period. And China, I think if one looks back historically, didn't fit that model, wasn't yet at the capitalist period that Marx talked about. Marx was writing primarily about countries such as Germany and the United Kingdom and in the middle of the 19th century. And Russia didn't really fit that model, although perhaps it was closer, and China was even farther away. So I think it's very important, even if one is following Marxist theory, that the implementation of the new economy is consistent with certain aspects of Marxism, in that one has to achieve the full aspects of the capitalist economy with market forces setting prices, and then move from that. And perhaps there might be some danger of exploitation. And then move from that to a purer socialist economy in which there is no longer exploitation, but the workers are getting back exactly what they put into things. And then finally, we could imagine that there is this final stage of collective communism with equality. Mm-hmm. And so I think that many foreign observers, especially my colleagues in the United States, don't understand that there is a way of explaining the current opening up of China and the reform in the context of Marxist theory. And I may not have done a perfect job of explaining that, but it's my understanding is that this is one way to see things.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. And then still talking about economy, let's move on to different specific topics. And the first one is fiscal and also tax policy. And also another one is the reform of the state-owned enterprises. We've been talking a lot about tax policy lately because we're having a reform when it comes to personal income tax in China right now. But I guess the reform during the course of the past 40 years is much more about this. So Victor, how would you summarize the reform in the realm of tax policy, fiscal policy of China? How did those reform measures help the country's economy?
Well, first of all, I think political and economic reforms in China over the past 40 years have been comprehensive and very substantive. And it included many, many things. And in many areas, it also required complete political breakthroughs and introducing new ideas and new concepts. Tax reform is just one of these great experiments. 40 years ago, the Chinese people were all locked up either as farmers on the people's commune in the countryside or as workers or laborers in the Chinese factories, for example, except for some bureaucrats in the government and party entities. Therefore, there was no concept of a tax because everyone kind of had already been pre-taxed. Wherever they work in the countryside or in the urban area, whatever they got was the net income, very, very tiny in themselves, and they did not need to pay any tax. And also, corporates owned by the government also did not need to pay tax. So you do not have the concept of individual income tax or corporate income tax and many other forms on items of taxation. And I think China need to really start from scratch and gradually came up with a system of taxation involving, for example, personal income tax, corporate income tax, and many other forms of taxes or levies, for example. And this whole system of taxation became part and parcel of the all political and economic reform. And also, allow me to emphasize one point. At the beginning of the economic and political reform, because China had a huge scarcity of capital, China was desperate to open its door and attract money and investment from foreign countries, including from Hong Kong and Macau, and later from Taiwan, for example. So when these money came in, what was the nature of this investment? How would you classify these investments? And what to do with the recovery of principal and eventually the income being generated on the investment, etc. When you start to deal with all these complicated things, then taxation became a very important tool, because eventually the government need to rely on taxation to collect the revenue and to allocate the money and to have enough expenditure for whatever items that the government entity would be involved in, as well as to allocate revenue from wealthy places in China to more backward regions in China in order to achieve certain kind of social equity across regions and across classes, for example. So I would say when we really do an in-depth analysis of the Chinese taxation over the past 40 years, it's a big mirror into how this very complicated social and political experiment involving reforms and opening up to the outside world proceeded here in China in reality.
So like Victor mentioned, regional equity. Michael, what do you think would be the role of tax reform when it comes to like handling relations between the central government and local governments and also the government and the market?
I think that it's crucial. Certainly redistribution is very important in the context of this sort of economic development, in which certain regions of the country, not to mention individuals, but certain regions of the country are prospering or have prospered much more than other regions. And one of the things that can be accomplished under China's form of government is more successful redistribution. In a Western democratic system, a federalist system such as that in the United States, for example, these are politically very difficult issues to redistribute wealth in a transparent way from one region of the country to another. Whereas in China, I think perhaps because of the socialist orientation, the concept that the country is trying as a whole to lift itself up economically, that it's easier for the government, the central government, to reallocate resources, to take the tax money basically to Beijing and then redistribute it as needed to the various provinces around the country. So I think that the type of government that is and the way it's operated is really crucial to the success of that redistributive effort. And to go back to something that Giles mentioned a little while ago, there perhaps is still room to develop certain areas, especially in the rural areas. I know the government has identified the total elimination of poverty as one of its objectives. And I think that another thing that I've noticed in reading about these issues in the last year is that there's an ongoing effort to try to develop the rural areas because the migration now perhaps has peaked to the cities, and some people are returning to the rural provinces, and it's important that they share the benefits of the economic miracle.
Mm-hmm. So Victor mentioned this tax reform could be seen as a mirror of the whole reform and opening up a process. I guess another mirror could be the reform of the state-owned enterprises in the past decades. So Giles, how did China manage to turn state-owned enterprises from like units under planned economy into market players? What are the experience and also lessons?
Well, I think it's been a long, hard road, but the key figure I would say here, apart from Deng Xiaoping, of course, whose vision really underpinned the whole exercise, was the Prime Minister under Jiang Zemin, Zhu Rongji, who undertook a very, very difficult, tough business of reforming the state-owned enterprises, which he did in 1994-95. And when I was living in Beijing, we employed as a cook, a lady in her 50s who had for many years worked for a state-owned enterprise, I think, in Anhui province. And her daughter was, or her husband, rather, was a relation of my family, my wife's family. So she came to cook for us, and she couldn't really cook at all. But I did learn a bit of her story and learned how severe the dislocation was for many millions of people. But this was the first big step towards rationalizing and putting the state-owned sector onto a much more stable, long-term basis. Then I think Zhu Rongji, some people in the West thought he was trying to dismantle the state-owned enterprise system. I don't think he was trying to do that at all. He was actually trying to strengthen it, make it work better. And then I think the next big step was privatization. In other words, taking minority stakes in many of the large enterprises like China Mobile, the banks, and so on, to the market and listing them, selling these minority stakes to international investors. And the idea was, that the market would impose much greater efficiency and drive change within these state-owned companies. And I think to some extent that's happened. In some areas, monopolies still apply, for example, telecom sector and others, banking too. And I think that the next big step here is actually to bring in more competition in some of these more restricted areas. And I think, in fact, that for some of the for the reform, because so difficult it is to do this, that pressure from outside, in first of all, the WTO agreement in 1999, which was carried out in 2001, brought pressure from China signing up to an international agreement, sort of external exogenous pressure onto the system, which made it much easier, perhaps, to make hard changes. And I think in the same way, funny enough, the trade war with Trump may perform some of the same job that joining WTO did, in the sense that the Chinese leadership on the left or on their own may find it really too hard to make some of the necessary changes. But when an external force arrives in the form of a trade war, like it is at the moment, then maybe it is much easier to carry out some of these tough reforms and lower tariff rates, bring more competition into some of the areas that need it in China. Mm.
Victor, how do you see this? What can we learn from the SOE reform in the past 40 years? Because we know it's pretty much still ongoing, like the mixed ownership reform we're seeing today.
Absolutely. 40 years ago, in the urban side of the equation in China, almost all the industrial productions were done by the SOE, state-owned enterprises. Private ownership was next to zero. And gradually, private ownership started to take form, and they developed very gradually. And then in the 1980s, all of a sudden, there was a big boost of the development of private ownership. But when we talk about the state-owned enterprises, the great difficulty of reform is that normally, allow me to say one thing, 40 years ago, China itself was like a big company, and the government was the general planner, and everything was planned to the detail. That's why we need all the coupons, for example, as to how much a person could buy and need and possess, for example. And however, the downside was that there was not a robust supply and demand equation, And everything was done by artificial planning. And eventually, many things actually went out of whack, and the supply and demand collapsed, and the productivity, efficiency collapsed, and then living standards plummeted. Therefore, when we really follow the market practice, that is the invisible hand, that is the supply and demand, that is all the freedom and the liberty in producing things to satisfy the ever-changing demand in the market, for example, then it would definitely require a very much revamping of the state-owned enterprises. 40 years ago, a state-owned enterprise is not a company that we now understand. It's basically a workshop. Mm. It produced without the need to analyze market demand. It basically produced according to government fiat as to how much you need to produce, what kind of things you need to produce, how many television sets or radio sets you need to produce. And you do not need to worry about whom do I need to sell these products to, whether the customers would have preferences, for example. Therefore, it was a very straightforward, simplistic way of production. And all this could not sustain in a real market economy. So I think the state-owned enterprises reform started very prudently because you really, as I mentioned, you really need new experiments, you need new paradigms, you need new legal framework, for example, legal concepts, all the supporting things like taxation, etc. And it took more time, and it also caused more turmoil in the cities and instability in many cases, especially, for example, under Premier Zhu Rongji, when he really did very brave reform of the state-owned enterprises by shutting down many of them or phasing them out or privatizing and laying off a massive amount of state-owned enterprises workers, for example. Many people actually resisted them. They wanted to go back to the old system where you have life-term employment, even though your pay and the quality of your life may not be very good, but at least you have the assurance of a job, for example. But these things could not be sustained in a market economy, and this is not allowed under socialism with Chinese characteristics. So I think state-owned enterprises reform became more and more urgent and became more and more important in China. And now, I would say, it's only halfway done because there are still a lot of very big state-owned enterprises. But the percentage of the state-owned economy in the Chinese economy as a whole came down from almost 100% to right now about 25%. Mm. And the private ownership in terms of the percentage of the economy, in terms of the percentage of labor force employed, in terms of new innovations, patents, copyrights, etc., produced, for example, already became a dominant percentage in China. So this explains why the Chinese economy is not static, it's very dynamic, it's very much entrepreneurial in nature, and it's becoming more and more innovative in nature.
Thank you very much, Victor. We're running out of the time of this program. Our panel is Michael Powers, Victor Gao, and Giles Chance. This is a big topic, China's reform and opening up, and we'll have further discussion in future programs about this 40th anniversary. I'm Sui. Have a nice weekend.